We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Hi, hello everyone. This is Michelle Lutala, and I'm here from edweb.net. This is my 75th webinar at EdWeb. We started, I can't believe this, but almost 7 years ago. And we are very grateful both to EdWeb and Mac and Via for sponsoring this community. And I'm here with my guest and friend, not necessarily in that order, my friend and guest, Joyce Walenza. And we're really excited to have her with us. And we're going to go through a few slides and she'll get a proper introduction and then even more of an introduction. And then she's really going to dazzle us with information. And so I think those of you who are looking for tools on how to teach this stuff are really going to be excited. So here's Joyce. And Joyce was a school librarian for 25 years. She's written and written and written more on school library worlds and therefore has been an inspiration to those of us in library world forever and ever. And I knew Joyce was like one of my first textbooks when I entered library school with Power Tools. And now she teaches at Rutgers University in the School of Communication in the Masters of Information and Library Science program. And she's won numerous awards, but her blog, Never Ending Search, is one of the most powerful go-to professional education tools we have, if not only for school librarians, but also for tech educators and tech leaders. So we're really excited to have her with us today. We want to give a giant thanks to our sponsor in this community, Mac and Via. They are an extraordinary service that provides free way to containerize all of your digital collection and your digital resources, including your databases and your ebooks. And they have fabulous collection and selection of e-resources, including audiobooks that are deliverable on Brightwave and also Mac and Via. So we are very grateful to them for sponsoring this community. And they have an advocacy program called TYSL for Transform Your School Library. It's an advocacy program and they tweet at that hashtag and they send out blog posts. And I know Marlene is here and she's an active leader in that group. They also have Mac and Maker custom kits and books and productions and products and inspiration that are available at macandmaker.com. I'm going to pitch that Lisa and some of the webinators here at edweb.net will be in San Antonio, Texas. I have my slides backwards, so that's this slide. So we have a poster session on Monday, June 26th at ISTE from 11 to 1. And my colleague Jackie Whiting and I will do a full day pre-conference workshop from 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on Sunday, June 25th at ISTE in San Antonio. And we encourage you to come and join us for the whole day of fun. It's called Where Kids Love Learning and Transforming Your School Libraries. Joyce has been nominated as a leadership luminary in the brand new recognition from AASL, the American Association of School Librarians. And we encourage you to go there, and especially after this webinar, I'm sure you'll be super, super inspired. And you will be able to vote for her and by basically giving an endorsement. And so the hyperlink for that is bit.ly/voteby414, which means that the vote has to be in by April 14th. And I've also been nominated for a different category. It's the curriculum category. So feel free to give us a shout out there if you can. This is a lie. Somebody stole my EdWeb ET75. That's never happened before. I had to put an A on that. So the new link for I've done this for 75 webinars. I've had a bit.ly and I've had my protocol all in place and I went to create it and somebody had already stolen it. So that's never happened before. So we are now 75A. So just add a little lowercase a to the end of that and you have our link. And I just put it in the chat. Okay, we are really starting now. that was a lot of housekeeping. We have a new four-letter word in our vocabulary, and it has those two letters, but it's not the one you're thinking of. It's this word. And so it's been shouted out across the band, across the broadcast news, and its fingers have been pointed at our journalists. And last month, we had Greg Tapo, who is a national education and democratic right reporter for USA Today. He came to us and we had an hour-long discussion about big, giant, grappling questions for journalists in today's landscape. And he had some really amazing conversations. He gave us a series of tips. All of those are, that whole conversation is archived and available at the EdWeb archives, webinar archives. And I encourage you to take a look at that and the chat, which was also a really dense discussion. That also was covered in eSchool News, so feel free to get a look at that. And that is in the link to today's website. So that actually, that conversation was started for me in my head about 5 years ago when I started, when I started really doing some hardcore work with this, with the Common Core. And I realized that with the Common Core, I keep losing track of where my mouse is. I kept thinking about this close reading piece. And at that very same time, I started doing some work with Rosen. Rosen was creating a digital literacy a database, and they wanted somebody to do some curriculum writing, and I did that. So they wrote this really, it was very avant-garde. They wrote this beautiful database of digital literacy tools, including lesson plans and materials and little interviews. And it was, for me, it was a real eye-opener. And I started to think about how to better teach digital literacy. So I've been thinking about this for a long time. And the conversation that we're having here is really just so exciting for me because I feel it's so validated. So today is part two of what I did, of what we did last month with Greg. And sort of for me, it's like a culmination of 5 years pondering all by myself, where I felt like I was just having this conversation in my own brain. And now it's a conversation that everybody wants to have. And I'm just so excited about this. So here we are. I want to talk a little bit about digital literacy, digital versus media literacy, because this is something I've been pondering. And this is a conversation I had with a number of school librarians back in December. What's the difference between digital media and media literacy? So this was a conversation that bounced back and forth, and I was kind of looking at it. We found a couple of resources, and here's where the cross section of digital and media literacy come together. And I made this Venn diagram, and I was reading their stuff, and I was trying to put it all together in this Venn diagram. And then I had like the, like, duh, why don't you just ask an expert? And I did. And Joy said, well, I kind of like your Venn diagram, but we've been talking about this a lot because we're developing a course for Rutgers University on emerging literacies. So this is something that we have been really discussing a whole great deal. So Joyce is here with me, and I went to her and I said, wait, what's the difference between digital and media literacy? And she said, well, your Venn diagram is really nice, but you'll notice that it's in black and white and it's not that simple. What it's really, she said, what did you say, Joyce? It had to do with a bucket.
I know. I said we're talking about buckets that are entirely porous. And although we try to make these things discrete containers, they're really not. I mean, there's definitely overlap. And what we're really talking about is literacy in general. I mean, we can't talk about literacy anymore without talking about news literacy, without talking about digital literacy, without talking about media literacy. So what we're talking about is ability to think. Yeah, we're thinking about the ability to think and create and learn and write and express ourselves across whatever it is that we get our information from. So, I don't know that the buckets are necessarily all that important anymore, although there are people who are media literacy scholars and there are people who are digital literacy scholars. You know, I think that we're talking, we need to get the partner teachers that we work with to understand literacy as one big thing, and basically that's where I stand. We'll go more deeply into this, but
Well, you That's actually you facilitated a different webinar on the same subject just last week. And I'm not sure whether it was Gary or Frank who said this, but you need to know how the news ecosystem works. And that's one of the elements of this elephant of literacy, as you call it. So there were some key concepts that were outlined for media literacy, and these were put out by the Center for Media Literacy. And you explained that you use this a lot.
Yeah, this is, if you haven't visited the Center for Media Literacy, I think it's one really important thing. There are some very important documents that can be used across those literacies that we're thinking about and applied to pretty much anything. I think the notion, and kids don't think about the notion that all media messages are constructed. And I think all you need to do is look at an infographic where we sometimes virally share them and put them out there without wondering, you know, who created this infographic and why. And many of the infographics we send out there as gospel information because they have data on them are really, some of them are propaganda messages. So we need to know how media is constructed and why it's constructed. Media messages have their own rules and their own language, and media is constructed of all sorts of things that we don't generally think about, like design issues, color issues, font issues. What does the color red mean? And people, and it is contextual. Different people experience the same message in different ways. Media have embedded values and points of view, and most media are organized to gain a profit or power or to convey a message and persuade. And so it's important that we actually come at this with a disposition of informed skepticism, or as I sometimes think of, the spidey senses.
Right.
Yeah.
So we found a graph where we looked for this cross section. And then when I talked to Joyce, really Joyce just said, it's about the disposition to be skeptical and be creative and have empathy. Those were the three things you said. And at the core of this are librarians. So also as part of that webinar and also your blog post that we will be talking about shortly, this was a quote from Joyce. And it was really, I thought, beautifully phrased and really well put together. And it really reflects some of the thoughtfulness that goes into what we're about to present. So living in an age of great complexity, and while we're talking about fake news here, this conversation, news comes in all sorts of flavors, and it's nuanced, and some things are not fake, but they may come from various lenses, and our learners need to learn to deal with this and this complexity. Things are not black and white or good or bad. They're all slightly different. It's really, really hard for us to grapple with the notion that there's no such thing as a neutral text. There is fake news, clearly, but there are also shades of news, and I want our learners to understand that. So thank you for that, because that is a really powerful message, and it's one we really need to think about. We're on the cusp of something bad.
Well, there's no easy way to do this. It is complex, and we need to present it as complex. And there's no longer room for saying Wikipedia is evil and JSTOR is good. Right. It is just not that simple. Or social media doesn't present authoritative news. Sometimes it gives us the best leads. And sometimes the New York Times displays bias. And so it's exciting. It's exciting to be teaching about this, and we're going to give you some strategies in a little bit.
So Joyce put together what she calls a toolkit, but actually it doesn't really quite look like that. It looks more like this. Because on Thanksgiving weekend, Saturday morning, I wake up and I see this tweet and it caught my attention. And it was this blog post. And that's still the blog post. And that's still the blog post. And that's still the blog post. It's a really, really comprehensive blog post. And we're going to get through as much of this together as we can. It's such a powerful resource that if all I have to do is go into my browser and type the letters N-E, and the first thing that comes up is this blog post. That's how often I refer to it. So as Joyce likes to say, it has always been up to the reader or viewer to make reliability and credibility decisions, but it's up to the reader or viewer to negotiate the truth. And that's what we're really talking about, is that nuanced capacity, that nuanced piece of truth. So we're going to start out, because you talk about this first in your blog post, word choice. How important is word choice, and what can we learn by thinking hard about word choice?
Well, I was a journalist for a while, and I recognized that my word, everything I wrote was carefully constructed. Who I interviewed, what parts of the quote I chose, how I angled the story. Somebody would come in and put a headline in after I wrote it. But just think about these word choices. When we say refugee, that has a different definition from the word immigrant. Certainly the classic is one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. I saw Renee Hobbs present a lesson where she showed a clip from the movie Suffragette. And the suffragettes in the film were called terrorists. And you have to, like, imagine you're back in that time. Those women took a lot of risks, and people did call them or think of them as terrorists. Now we think of them as heroines or heroes. And so, you know, how we frame something, and we can compare words. We can put two articles next to each other on the same topic and look at the difference in word choices, and we can choose two articles. I know James was talking about middle school. Choose two middle school level articles and see what a difference word choice makes in the way we view something. I don't want to belabor this, but there's dictionaries. Allsides.com has a dictionary where people have argued almost Talmudic style over what these words mean, and you get right, center, and left definitions of some of these choices.
This is actually a great exercise, and it's one we've done many times in many ways. This was part of an article that Ed Week did at our school, and we were literally trying to get the kids to look at the Kaepernick story, where he's kneeling during the pledge or during the Star Spangled Banner, and we looked at four different publications where we looked at that one issue, and we had the kids dissecting the language in order to do this. This is a link that's also included in today's resources. It's a video I made a few years back. We were looking at immigration. We were looking at basically two think tanks. Side by side, but the kids didn't know it was a think tank. One of them had a great chronology of U.S. legislation on immigration. So, I don't know, 100 years, different laws that had passed. But when we went to the About page, we were astounded at the deep difference between these two sources. So that's a nice video that's there. It's an instructional video I put together for a class. I couldn't be in the class, so I just made a video out of it.
And Michelle, just conscious of the fact that we have people here from all over the world, not all news is Western. And if we mix this stuff up and put an article from the UK next to an article that was written somewhere here in the United States, or an article from the Middle East, all being in English perhaps, let's take a look at what news looks like when it's not reported from our major media here in the US.
This has been a fun exercise. We've been looking at article from 2013 in North Korea, looking at the same issue where it's talking about the New York Times. And wow, it's really, really amazing what you can see, what kind of a difference that is. One of the things I didn't do in this video, and this is something that Joyce's blog post alluded to, is the concept of triangulation. Oh, here's Allsides Dictionary. So I talked to us a little bit about triangulation, because that's where I failed to direct the kids.
Well, I think as a normal part of the research process, we need to ask kids, can you corroborate the information you found in one source? If it's only available in one source, that should set up all sorts of red flags, or if it's disagreed with in other sources. So it's not that hard if you're doing research to see if a fact can be checked. And in the blog post, I list a whole bunch of places where you can do fact checking, but basically check in a few different news sources and see if you find it. And if you don't, then you've got some problems.
So one of the things that has made this, there are several things that have made it a very hot topic right now, but one of them, outside of the obvious presidential outcome, the outcome of the presidential election, which I think surprised many, many people, there was the Stanford History Group did a fabulous study, and those results came out right around the same time in November. And Joyce really starts by her blog post by covering it pretty extensively. Here's some of the language that comes out of the report. So this report shocked them into reality. At every level, we were taken aback by the students' lack of preparation. In fact, they had created assessment tools that they thought, ah, this is too easy. And then once they started piloting their resources, their assessments with the audiences that they were working with, they realized, oh wait, they're failing so miserably. We have to redo these assessments.
And Michelle, as we go into this, I want people to think about, these are absolutely doable assessments that you can use with today's news and whatever you're doing across the curriculum. Just pick a different homepage, a different image, or use these. These are so appropriate for pretty much middle school through high school.
Yep.
Probably some elementary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So here's just a quick quote, you know, never before, and I won't I just focus on the yellow. Like literally focus on the yellow. Yeah, we've got a lot of information at our fingertips, but it's kind of on us as educators to a large extent. And librarians in particular have really amazing capacity to make the difference between making us all smarter and better or more ignorant and narrow-minded. And democracy is at stake. And those are really powerful, that's powerful language coming out of the executive summary. So on this one exercise, feel free to discuss it if you want to do this, or we can just kind of, we've got a couple of highlights where they break down a couple of
decisions. It's crazy. This was crazy. This really struck me as shocking. You see where that sticky note is, where it says in the light blue, sponsored content. 80% of middle schoolers couldn't identify it as sponsored content. And you actually, if you download the, I don't know, maybe it's a 10-page little PDF, you can see they labeled what was an advanced response, an emerging response, and a really, you know, wrong response. And you can see the kids just didn't understand what an ad was. It sounded like a good story. Go ahead.
So their recommendation was, we should be teaching kids about sponsored content. They should know what that language means as early as, those of you who are elementary school folks, elementary school. They specifically made that recommendation. In another exercise, and you know what? This is the kind of thing, I didn't even know that this existed. Another thing is they wanted to make sure that students knew how to recognize that blue check mark that's pointed to with an arrow in Facebook. That is a verified page. And back in 2013, they made verified pages and profiles for celebrities and for news organizations primarily. But that's something that students need to be aware of, and most students got that wrong. On the other hand, since 2013, there's a whole slew, all you have to do is Google this, a slew of organizations that have basically workarounds on how to get that blue check mark on their website. So that's not necessarily such a great indicator at this point. Another thing that they were, surprisingly, kids did understand what that blue X in the corner of a box meant, but that didn't lead them to the right answer when they were trying to discern what is news. So that little blue X where you close it out. So yeah, you've got fashion advertising on this North Korean nukes article, but they weren't able to dig deeper. They knew to turn off the box. They knew to click the X to make it go away, but they were not able to look in depth beyond that. Joyce, you want to talk about this one?
Yeah, this one is really striking. So they asked students if they could verify or judge the credibility of this image, which presents Gerber daisies and suggests that these daisies had mutated because they were near the Fukushima nuclear plant. And they said, you know, is this credible? And only 40% of high school students said that it presented strong evidence because it was 40% of students believed it. But there's no tie for these daisies to the location of the plant. And what they didn't say in the report that I find really fascinating, that my students at the high school would have been able to do, and certainly my graduate students, would be to take a screenshot of that image and drag it into Google reverse image search. The very third thing that comes up is the Snopes. And people argue about whether Snopes is reliable, but at least it sets up, hey, take a look at this. This photo has been here and there and there, and it didn't necessarily come from Japan. And it also says that there are mutations of daisies all over the place, and it doesn't necessarily it's not necessarily a result of a nuclear accident. But all you needed to do was grab that. Now, they may not have been able to do that within the restrictions of an exam, but those are the sorts of things we need to have new kinds of strategies with images. Certainly, you would be suspicious of this because there's nothing tying this image to that space, which is a lesson in you can do all sorts of things to put media together and tell a story that may or may not be true. But reverse image search is a very, very powerful tool in credibility or crap detection, as Howard Rangold calls it.
Great. And the next one was, so their recommendation on that is where did this document I'm looking at come from? That was their language. Students need to think about that for every single one thing that they look at. So here are the five concepts that we talked about before. There are five questions that will help students make those determinations. Than 50% failed on this. Go ahead.
So people think data is great, or our data are great. And so they're looking at a poll and they're trying to judge the authority of this tweet. And very few people were able to identify the fact that MoveOn.org actually is an organization with a strong political point of view. They didn't question the fact that a poll that was shared by MoveOn.org might be statistics that we chose for a particular reason, maybe not a balanced set of statistics. But really interestingly, nobody clicked on the link, or very few students actually clicked on the link to see if they could verify it. So Michelle, you look like you want to say something.
As a part that the kids that did want to learn more, instead of clicking on the link, they did outside searches and they searched for CAP, which got them nothing right about this tweet. That was the blue.
However, when they searched for MoveOn.org, the kids who went out and actually did some serious searching, made some discoveries, put that in their responses, and there were some exemplary responses. Mm-hmm. My guess is the kids who responded had school librarians. That's what I think. I don't know for sure. I don't remember what the sample was. There's a lot of Google image. Basically, just take one, like a 5-minute break. Not a 5-minute. All you need to do is drag an image from your desktop into the Google image search box when you see that there's a little icon, and so you go to images.google.com and just drag an image in or upload it, and then you'll get results from where they suspect it came from.
I have a tutorial for that. I'll put it in the results. I'll put it in the sources.
Good for assessing who the originator of an image is, if you need to cite them, or if you suspect kids are using images that ought to be cited. It's good for that too.
Well, their recommendation on this was to, and this speaks back to what Rachel is saying here, is that kids might have been suspicious about using external links, but students they need more instruction on how to actually navigate the social media. So they should be taught what to look for in social media tweets or in tweets or in Facebook posts that would make them think it's suspicious and it's something they should not click on. So I want to talk about social media. You touched on this really briefly, but there's 6 in 10% of Americans, or 6 out of 10 Americans, according to Pew, get their news from social media. And you brought up in your blog post that UNESCO put together this amazing thing. And one of the first rules that they have is this one. And you want to talk about it? Because you make great points about it.
I'm having trouble reading it.
It's the equity piece. It's the equity his. That's your.
Now, please read it, because I can't.
So I'll read it to you. For me. So it's basically law number one is that the information, it's basically that there is no good source or bad source of media. And this is really a leveling of the playing field. So, to say that it's what you said earlier, that Wikipedia is bad, or that social media is not a good source for your sources. And one of the other things you liked about the UNESCO piece was the equity, that everyone has a right to. Yeah.
I need to bring these slides up on my own. You're following the right hashtags, you're following some solid at signs, you're getting breaking news, you're getting links to primary sources. Social media can be an excellent source if we teach kids how to use it well. So let's move on. Next one.
Yep. Jane Sings, So this one is every citizen is a creator of information and knowledge. And you touched on this in the webinar last week, and you touch about it on it again in your blog post. The law number three is that messages are always not always value neutral or independent. Right.
And that's okay. I think one of the things we do early on is teach kids that bias is bad. Bias is not bad. We need points of view in research. I don't think neutral text really exists, but it's the aggregation of these things that we collect in a works cited list. It's not all that you need. Every source needs to be a peer-reviewed journal, but the idea that you can defend the sources as putting the puzzle together and drawing the picture for you. And you need a variety of lenses to really understand a story.
The last, this is number four, not the last one. So every citizen every citizen wants to know and understand new information, knowledge, and messages, even if they're not aware of it. They want it. And I like this.
This is where we come in. You will understand. We're going to help you, and we're going to do it across the curriculum. And as at least in our world, we're going to do it across the curriculum and across the grade levels. And we're going to make it interesting and exciting. Yeah.
This is a great message for us. Like, this is like, okay. Oh, wait, you have a real job.
And okay. But I think we're laughing about this, but one of the most important things about this is it's not just AASL, it's UNESCO. And it's acknowledging that kids all over the world live in different information ecosystems. And some children have far more filtered lives. Some people have, some kids do not have access to technology at all. Some people have a textbook, and that's all the information they have. So I think this acknowledgement is important internationally.
Yep. And the last one is that people don't learn all this stuff at once.
Right. It's not taught in ninth grade in September when you have the orientation for the library. It's sustained, it's interdisciplinary, it's across grade levels, and it needs to be an effort that is a school-wide effort. And I think this is an opportunity right now to make that happen.
So we're going to talk about fake news for a little bit. And just so you have a sense of the sequence, folks, we're going to talk about fake news for a little bit, and then we're going to talk about, like, in the classroom, like, literally new media literacy tools to use in the classroom. There's a gazillions of them. And then the last piece is where we talk about sort of the news detection tools. So we talked about hoaxes, came up in the chat. So that's pretty much the next three chunks of how we're going to spend our time. So fake news, you described there are four kinds of fake news that you mentioned. I attended a webinar the same day I attended your webinar. I went to another webinar that was hosted by PBS, and one of the speakers was Monica Brady Meyerhoff. And if you haven't been to seen ListenWise, she is the founder of ListenWise, and she had a 20-year career in public radio, and she created this database of mostly National Public Radio segments, and she has created curriculum to help teach it. So it's a very select group. It's completely tied to national standards, and it's very, very, it's well organized for K-12 learning, mostly in middle and high school, but she's working across the grade levels. And she added this handful of words. So also mistakes. And as a journalist, that came up last week too, or last month too, that, you know, people make mistakes, journalists make mistakes. And the problem with the landscape we're dealing with now is that they're suddenly accused of being fake news disseminators when they do something as human as making a mistake. They really don't like that. And that was one of the things she focused on. You talked about this, the fake news search engine.
Right. There's a few of these tools that help identify fake news. And I don't have all of them, but, Polyfact and Snopes. Oh, you probably have them as slides.
They're way down on the list. Yeah. There is one for real or satire. And there was one for a hoax that I thought really merited coming
right
here.
And Michelle, we're going to make this point again later, but what we're creating for kids on the ground in our schools is these toolkits. And so what are you going to curate on your LibGuide, on your Wiki, on your Wix or Weebly site that is going to help kids discern credibility. So there are these tools that we're mentioning, and then we're going to also think about what we're curating for them as go-to places or start pages. And that's an important thing we'll talk about in a little bit.
So what is post-truth?
I don't know. What does the audience think? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it is an accurate statement, but it is definitely the word of the year from Oxford English Dictionaries. I don't have the definition in front of me. Do you, Michelle?
I don't, but I know that it actually, but here are some rules of thumb coming from Joyce Valenza. So these were your rules of thumbs in order to kind of look for news that is true in a world anyone can say whatever they want.
Yes, and I want to give some caution about some of these rules. They don't all work. There is something I mentioned earlier when we were taught before the webinar. There's something called astroturfing, and astroturfing is when they mask who they are. So they're not coming out front and saying, and fake news sites are not necessarily going to say, "Hey, look at me, I'm fake." And so that's something to be careful about. There are some new URLs that you should be especially suspicious of. You've got that.
Yep.
They end in .lo and there's .com, .co, as you can see in that ABC. And if you look at the different logos, there's slight differences between the authentic ABC logo and the simulated ABC logo. And this, you know, I think we need to frame this as kind of exciting detective work. And I think we need to take kids away from those hoax sites and really look at what's really out there, not the stuff that's been created to have fun with.
Here's one that this was actually funny. This happened while I was putting these slides together. This popped up and I was like, oh, wait, what is this? And then it looks like breaking news from CNN and this guy, Anderson Cooper, there. And like literally the graphics are pretty similar. But if you look closely, this is what it brought me to. You know, free trial, risk-free, guaranteed, whatever brain-powered medicine that is that you can take. So that's the kind of thing that just in doing this kind of investigation that came up for me.
So, before we leave that idea, I mean, I just think that kids ought to be kind of suspicious of things that are sensational. If a story says, quoting this source, you don't just accept it from that third person quote, you go to the source, you go to the Pew study, you find out who was quoted and you see if you can corroborate that. The other thing that I think is important as we ask questions is at what point in the story are you getting this information? You'll see from any major journalistic organization, the beginning of the story is going to look a lot different from the story as it progresses over the course of weeks. Let's move on to this. So these are, if we're going to introduce vocabulary words to students these days, these are vocabulary words worth introducing. So confirmation bias is the kind of thing where you want the information to look like this. So you look for information that confirms what you think. The filter bubble is that you've been tending, your search engine knows who you are. It knows whether you're a Democrat or Republican. It knows the sorts of things you love to click on. And so it starts feeding you the stuff you like rather than everything that's out there. When we live in an echo chamber, like I probably live in an echo chamber on Twitter and Facebook, I'm only hearing the stuff that people I like and know are giving me. I'm not hearing anything from the outside world. Herbert Simon came up with the notion, the portmanteau word of satisficing. You know, the quickest point between two points is a straight line. People will not go around and put a lot of energy into something when they can satisfy the need very quickly. Container collapse is one that I think I invented, but I'm not sure. It's like when we had a newspaper in front of us, we could see what was on the front page, what was in the op-ed section, whether it was on page 35, whether it was above the fold. We could see the byline more clearly. We could see whether it was a newspaper or a journal. If everything is on screen or if everything's printed on 8.5 by 11 paper, the container is no longer there for us. And some of the clues that we had about what type of content we had are no longer present. We also know that not all journalistic content is written by journalists or experts. A lot of millennials I know personally right now are hired because they want to be writers. They're hired by content farms or content mills. And so they write news stories, sometimes all well-meaning and sometimes very well fact-checked, but they are paid for by organizations. And we get lots of this content in front of us as we search, and we don't realize that it's sponsored by the American Dairy Association or something, and somebody has paid for that. That's also true of scientific journals. We get sponsored studies, and when you see a study has been sponsored not by the government, but by a pharmaceutical company, you ought to be a little bit suspicious about the results of that study. Virality is, you know, we say that fake news is not news. The difference about fake news these days, and we've seen fake news since, Jonathan Swift wrote A Modest Proposal, and there are definite examples of Civil War photography being a little bit manipulated. But what's different now is scale and the notion of virality, how easily something is spread. Herding phenomenon is just what it seems to mean. That everybody kind of jumps on a story, and people who know each other tend to agree. And so sometimes when you see a like in something because other people like it, you'll like it as well. And so I don't want to belabor any of this, but these are new vocabulary words that I think we ought to teach kids starting in middle school. Okay.
I'm glad you walked us through that. This is the Learning Work Network from the New York Times. And you said you had included a number of videos in your blog post, and this is one, and it features how to choose your news. They also have a couple of additional, they had a brand new.
That video, so good. Do that.
I knew you were excited about that video, so I wanted to make sure you said that.
Okay.
They also just added this new lesson, evaluating sources in a post-truth world, ideas for teaching and learning about fake news. So that's also coming from the New York Times. The Digital Resource Center was, I believe, this is the Stony Brook. Stony Brook has some amazing content.
Oh, yeah. They've got a center for news literacy. So they've got lesson plans and definitions. And that's just a very rich, and it's a fabulous portal. Just that might be one of your starting points if we had a top 10 list.
I know my middle school librarians, when they were reading your post sitting next to me at a PD day, don't tell our bosses. And they fell into this and they went crazy. They love it. The News Literacy Project was one of the people who you featured in your webinar, and you're really excited about this. Was that
Checkology?
That's right.
Yeah, that's a slide the Basso. Yeah, he's got a program that's now free. You can sign up for it. It's got some multimedia instruction, and it's called Checkology, and it's appropriate, I think, for intermediate through high school.
And that's in the sources, and we have a slide for it. I don't know why it's not right here, but it's coming up. So we'll
say, definitely from the News Literacy Project. Yeah.
thank you. This is actually again Monica Brady Meyeroff with this Listen Wise, but she had a couple of really good points. She had the simpler version of the questions when we looked at those, basically the five themes of media literacy, and then we had five affiliated questions that followed up later. These are maybe the simpler versions that we might want to use with maybe middle schoolers or even elementary school. And I liked that part because sometimes because Joyce and I both taught high school and now Joyce is teaching higher ed, that it's we want to make sure that we get there. And these are some of the lessons that they have in Listen Wise also. This was another slide that she shared that I really liked. And, you know, again, coming at it from the angle of a reporter, she's really sensitive to the kinds of misinformation that exist out there. So false connections, false content, manipulated content, satire, parody. We've talked about this a little bit, misleading content, imposter content, and fabricated content. So recurring theme throughout this entire discussion is that there is nuance here. It's not fake news or good or real news or truthful news, that there are levels to all of this. So in your webinar last week, There is Checkology. I knew it was coming up. So this is what was featured by, refresh the name.
Damaso.
I'm blanking. Yeah, there we go. And this is a new product, brand new. You were just learning about it when you wrote the post, and this was your first time seeing it live.
Yeah.
You were really excited and you wanted to give a shout out to, the digital.
Mike Ribble.
Yep.
Yeah.
And
he has 9 elements that I think are just part of what we need to be teaching in schools. And Mike's had this model out there for many years. So it's definitely worth taking a look at.
This has already come up in the chat. The Newseum featured.
Yeah, front pages of, there's so much there and there's lessons there as well. And it's worth a visit if you're ever in the DC area. But one, the lessons are fabulous, and you can go there every morning for front pages of newspapers to look at comparisons. I think it has pretty much every major newspaper. I'm not sure if it does global, but Kiosko, there's some love from Joanne. Yeah, I'm going to look it up. I think I've got it right. If somebody could check that for me, I think it's Kiosko.
It
another
is.
One that presents newspapers from all over the world. There's a bunch more I can share
I'll add that one to the resources, but it's kiosko.net. We use that a lot. Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to point out is that Joyce talked about each of these resources in depth. So she said, go to the Newseum, and then she would list 3 additional links. I did not feature screenshots of every single one of those links. So for example, here for the Center for Media Literacy, she talked about specific elements within there that you should go to.
Right. Yeah, I don't remember them all.
Right. I knew that was going to happen. It's okay. We're the Media Education Lab was another one, and I have a blog post here, but we're going to kind of blow through a whole bunch.
I have a few magic bullets I want to get to at some point. So let's move through the resources.
Okay.
And this, I love this. I don't know if you have any more slides on this. This is Frank Baker's site. It's called the Media Literacy Clearinghouse. And you need to dig into this, because what this does is it really has stuff kids are going to fall in love with. So around Super Bowl time, you can use, he's collected all the Super Bowl ads and has templated questions for you to ask about what these ads really mean. He's got the same thing for Academy Awards. And my very favorite lesson was he gathered all the magazine covers of the major candidates by candidate, and you can compare. What does Hillary look like on this magazine cover versus this magazine cover in the same point of time in the campaign? What do the colors mean? Is she a caricature or a photograph? How was she staged? What is she wearing? I mean, all of these things are really highly constructed media messages. This is so rich, and this is so engaging for kids. Dig into this. There's stuff on political cartoons. There's stuff on political ads. This is great. Okay, sorry, let's move on.
No, that's good. I knew you were excited about that.
Oh, and this is for upper level high school. And Craig Silverman from Pointer and also from BuzzFeed started this right after Hurricane Sandy, when we were started realizing in a 24/7 news cycle, journalists were going crazy to find out what was going on all over the place, all over the East Coast relating to Hurricane Sandy, and whether these images were true. So what they started putting together was how in a crisis, how do journalists verify social media? And these lessons for journalists are great lessons, not for middle school, but for upper level high school students. And there are fabulous essays written by journalists. And this stuff matters when you're in the middle of a crisis. How do you know what's true and what's not true? And there's three parts of this right now.
Time for kids.
And the other thing is, as we're curating stuff, Oh, no. Okay, that was a phone call coming in. Sorry. Oh, I love this. Again, this is, if you know the ACRL standards, authority is constructed and contextual, or maybe the opposite way. This is a portal of information literacy lessons, not just for university, but it's by the standard. So you can go to the credibility standard, that frame in the framework, and see the lessons. And these are beautiful and they're very adaptable and they're all Creative Commons licensed. And there's Merlot as well. There's a bunch of other ones. And if you have a journalism department in your school, if you want to teach kids how to write, those are some things that I'm getting an error message, but let's keep going.
Okay. The article by school librarian of the year, Laura Gardner, on teaching information literacy now. We have a fake news in a post-truth world by Judy Morellian. We're kind of just throwing resources at you very fast because we're looking.
I wanted to talk about a couple of the ones coming up though.
This is Shannon's.
This is Shannon's, and this was a crowdsourced group of lessons about media literacy, and some of the ones we're going to be talking about are listed here. This is just a garden that will just start planting all sorts of media literacy seeds in your school. So visit that and contribute to it.
Yep. I'm just reminding everybody that all of these sources are in the resource list for today. There are 85 links in that Pearl Trees for today. And last month was also very rich and dense. There were 75 last month. There's a lot of resources we're directing you to. We can't get to all of them in an hour.
All right. So like I've been doing this for 25 years and I know some of you in this audience, I know you have been doing this as well. So one of the things I did, this is about school culture. It's not about what's going on in the library. And so I recognized that current events was happening all over the school. It was happening in science. It was happening in social studies. It was happening in language arts. It was happening across the grade levels. And the teachers were asking stuff about the five W's. And I was, or four W's and the H, the how, I don't know. In any case, I thought that these were really, really weren't the right questions to ask. And so if we initiate a scaffold for thinking about current events across the curriculum, we could make cultural change. So add to the W's. What is your prior knowledge? What do I always already know? What type of writing is this? Is it news? Is it op-ed? Is it essay? Is it a blog post? Can I discern any bias? Have I been able to verify that this information exists somewhere else? What journalists call the nut quote. If I could take one quote from this article and have it represent the article itself, what would it be? And then the so what? Does this matter and why does it matter? And you know what? Take this, it's in a Google Doc, and just grab it, make a copy, and edit it and ask the questions that you want and put the onus of the work on the kids. So if they're going to present current events, have them do the thinking by scaffolding the thinking. And then I don't know if the next slide is the one that I was thinking about, but So the next thing is, and I have some, maybe it's the annotations?
Not sure that one made it in.
Okay.
Come later.
So I propose that that what the other thing we do is before kids assemble a works cited list, that they annotate at the elementary level, ask them three questions. And those three questions might be, how did you find this information? What search tool did you use? Who is the author and why should you trust him or her? And then why? Why did you choose this particular source? Is it relevant to your inquiry? How does it help you answer your question? At the high school level, you know, and for middle school, I had a list of these. And I said to the teachers, pick three or four of these criteria for an evaluative annotated work cited. You get fewer sources, but the sources that you get are of far higher quality. And so we can ask things like, who is the intended audience? What is the scope? What is the purpose of this work? How does this compare with the others in my works cited list dealing with the same topic? If it's research, can you evaluate the research? Can you discern author bias? Does it inform? In what way does it inform your argument or increase your understanding? And for upperclassmen, was this research funded and by whom, if it's a research article? But there's a list of those, and that's linked to in that blog post. And again, take that stuff and play with it with your faculty. Ask them what they would value in student work cited, and then just make that a cultural thing. Whenever students do a bibliography or a work cited list, put the onus on them to discern the credibility and to think about that work cited list not as individual items, but as a whole, how do these puzzle pieces fit together in telling the story of what I learned? Okay, yep. Let's move on.
Okay. So news literacy, this is where we talked about, these are the places that we go to check the news that we're reading and to give students a body of resources to use and tools to go do that. So do you want, just, I'm going to.
Yeah, I just want to say there's a bunch of them. Some are more respected organizations than others, but I think, again, it's the triangulation or the corroboration. But what I would do is take these slides and just create some search boxes or put those links and those little icons on a website so that students immediately have this. They don't have to go, oh, what did Ms. Lutala say? But just have that as a page on your website. And then there are models.
Right. So this was I think this one comes out of California State University at Chico. And I've used this document and I adapted it into a Google form a couple of years ago. And then I had the kids doing peer review. So they were looking at another student's work and checking whether they had met these criteria using the CRAAP test. And that was kind of an interesting way. And then they had scoring at the end. And I don't necessarily think that this is a prescription because Joyce just said earlier, there is no 100% way to guarantee that it's not true. So I'm not sure I would still use this.
And David Warlick keeps talking about the context of the information need and the context in which this was written. So that Japanese nurse's blog, she was a first responder after the nuclear accident in Japan, she would fail this credibility test. But there are new types of primary sources and there are new experts. So the student writing the rationale, this is a good rule of thumb. I think all of these are. But I do think there are new rules, and I would love students to be creative and to tell me why they think this is an important source for them to use. And you may not be able to, there are questions we should ask about tweeters and bloggers that are different questions from these.
This was Kathy Schrox. Very simple questions. Keep it simple. So for those of you who are elementary school teachers, and I hear a lot of you out there, you can start with these.
And I think these are more applicable to social media. And this is the fart test. And it's, I think it's Amy Gillespie, and it was a recent Knowledge Quest blog, and it's another acronym. And also, these are all good guides, and I think they're great starting points. So pick the scaffold that you think is best for the kids, but also give them a wild card. Say, hey, prove to me that this is a valuable source. And don't, I think that demonizing any particular source of media may not be the best approach we take as information professionals who value intellectual freedom and value emerging media as well as traditional media.
This was from Evaluating Sources, the RADAR framework.
Yeah.
And then I know you wanted to talk about curation. This is what we were going to wrap up with.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I think I use this. I use Headline Spot, and there's this thing called the Start Spot Network. When I create libguides and pathfinders and things, this is one of my go-to places. This basically gives you news by subject. It gives you all the op-ed, the major news wires. It gives you international papers. It gives you columnists. If you wanted to start gathering news sources, this is a good place to go. And also it has children's news sources. So, I think one of the things we really have to do for our entire schools is create a news page. And so we do have our databases, but as I say all the time, your collection is not just what you purchase, it's what you point to and make available. So let's pull together the major news sources, maybe the five places we want kids to explore, as well as our Opposing Viewpoints databases and our Rosen databases. Let's put together a great current event page for every level and curate them. And what we're doing here is not just cutting meat for children. We're showing them how to organize their own information world. What would your own start page look like? What would you put on it? That way they're not just going to Google all the time or going to CNN, but they get a variety of choices and they see there are choices in their news. So I know we're supposed to be wrapping up.
That's okay. One thing we talked about last week, this came up and you said, don't do this because.
I don't remember who created this model. I think it's an okay start, but whoever it was decided to organize news in terms of its bias or non-bias. And there it looks like there's two different versions. But, you know, as I look at NPR smack dab in the center there, I don't think NPR is necessarily smack dab in the center. I think that should be on the left. I think the New York Times should be on the left. But I also think it's not about the whole newspaper, magazine, or journal. It's about the individual item, right? It's about the piece that you're reading. And if we decide the whole journal is left, right, or center, then we're not really evaluating the news we're getting, are we?
So I'm going to wrap up with this nice quote from you. I transcribed it from your webinar, and then I realized it was in the blog. Nurturing information literate, responsible, active citizens is what librarians do. So this is where we come in. There are no guarantees of truth from any source. We teach students to be discerning consumers of information. We teach them to deconstruct media messages and construct their own messages. We teach them to interrogate their sources. As the landscape continues to shift, librarians must update their own skill sets and toolkits to guide students in navigating a growingly nuanced universe of news. We must also examine and recognize our own biases so that we are open to contrary and conflicting ideas. This is our banner to wave, our curriculum to teach. She finishes the blog post with a couple of other beautiful thoughts, but I really thought I'd done enough reading for you. And so here are some final links to other sources, including another bunch of awesome blog posts by Joyce, and also a really critical article by Debbie Abelock, a couple with a few other links. The resources for today, there are many, are at that. Everything we've talked about except Kiosko and the link to the video on how to do a Google reverse image search are in that, and they will be shortly as soon as I finish here. I want to give a huge, huge thank you to my friend and colleague now. This is exciting. We're teaching a course together this summer at Rutgers along with Shannon Miller. And my colleague and friend, Joyce, we're very happy to have you. Thank you so much. A huge, huge thank you to Mac and Via for sponsoring this webinar.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.